Since it's obviously very nice and short, we'll start out just by reading through it. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Gracious One, according to this translation, the Gracious One was dwelling near Sarvati in Jeta's wood in Anathapindika's monastery. And at that time, many young boys who were between Sarvati and Jeta's wood were catching little fish. Then the Gracious One, having dressed in the morning time after picking up his bowl and robe, was entering Sarvati for alms. The Gracious One saw those very many young boys who were between Sarvati and Jeta's grove catching fish. Having seen that, he went to those young boys, and after going, he said to those young boys, "Are you afraid, boys, of suffering? Is suffering unpleasant to you?" And they replied, "Yes, Reverend Sir, we are afraid of suffering. Suffering is unpleasant to us." And the Gracious One, having understood the significance of it, on that occasion uttered this exalted utterance. If you have any fear of suffering, if suffering is unpleasant to you, don't do any bad deeds, whether in the open or in secret. But if you will do, or now do bad deeds, if you will do, or now do bad deeds, is that how it goes? Something like that. For you there is no freedom from suffering, even after going while running away. Now, the last verse, phrasing of the last verse in the translation is a bit obscure, but I'll come back to that in a minute. Anyway, on the whole, sutta should be fairly straightforward, right? Nice, simple one. You're breathing a sigh of relief, thinking, finally, something that makes sense. Excellent. So, I'd like this to be give you a chance for discussion and so on. And so I don't want to talk too much, but anyway, I'll start out by just giving a little bit of background and so on in this particular collection and the sutta. But please feel free to interrupt and ask questions at any time. Yeah? Any questions so far? No? You. Okay.
So, yeah. Thank you. Sorry, Bhante, I just have a different, just to say I have a different translation from you, so which I liked. I haven't read the other one.
Okay.
But you read it, and it instead of suffering it causes, it says pain,
uh-huh.
Which is kind of more real to me anyway.
Mm. Yeah. How does that one translate the last verse?
If we are afraid of pain, if pain is hateful to you, do not an evil deed openly or in secret. And if ye shall do an evil deed or do one now, there's no escape from pain, though ye spring up and flee.
Though you spring up and flee.
Hmm.
There's no escape from pain, whether you spring up and flee. Ah, okay, interesting translation. Okay, we'll come back to that last line. It's a bit obscure even in the Pali, so that's why the translations are quite different. Okay. Pain versus suffering, which one's better? See, the word in Pali, of course, is dukkha, right? And dukkha, of course, has a range of different meanings, and one of the meanings, obviously, as here, meaning just simple physical pain, right? And that's what he's asking about. So sometimes, this is one of the reasons why this sutta is interesting, because obviously it's a teaching for children, right? And there's not many teachings for children that we find in the suttas, yeah? So this is quite interesting to look at how the Buddha approached education for kids, right? So this is actually very interesting, because this is something that comes up all the time. People always coming to me and wanting me to do classes for kids and stuff like that, and they're wanting me to teach their children about Buddhism. And I use this sutta as an example for how it's completely unnecessary to teach their children about Buddhism, because they already understand about Buddhism. And then I use this sutta to show. Yeah. Because, of course, the point of the sutta is that the kids already know what's right and what's wrong. Yeah? So, which is better? Is suffering or pain better? For dukkha? Right. Pain is more. Pain is more instinctive, but pain can also mean mental suffering. Nicholas.
I think suffering is better because suffering includes a mental part and the fish have a consciousness. It's not just a physical thing. There's some awareness going on there too. So I think the word suffering covers the pain and also the mental suffering of the fish getting tortured.
Vin, were you going to say something?
Pain is better because everybody experiences pain, whether in mental or physical, but everyone sometimes doesn't suffer. They don't know that it's incorrect or wrong. So suffering seems more broad, pain seems more immediate.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you find context that either one is... can be better. Of course, you also find more kind of, if you like, philosophical translations of dukkha, yeah? Like Venerable Tanisaro translates dukkha as stress. So this is another one you see around the place, and sometimes people use unsatisfactoriness, yeah? And when people argue in favour of these kinds of translations, what you find, if you look at the form of the argument, is that they always argue from some kind of abstract philosophical sense, right? So they'll say that, you know, dukkha is like the existential suffering of being, and so suffering is not right, or pain is not right, you know. So they come from a philosophical argument, yeah? And that actually just reflects a bias in how we tend to approach Buddhism and how we tend to approach Buddhist text, because we tend to approach it by looking at the philosophical texts and the very kind of pitched high-level texts. And we tend to be very ignorant of the ordinary language usages that you actually find in Pali. Like, what does the word dukkha mean, not in the context of Buddhist philosophy, but what did the word dukkha mean just to kids playing with fish by a pond, right? This is not a Buddhist philosophical usage of the word dukkha, right? This was the word that when the Buddha used it, that he took it for granted that these kids will know exactly what he meant, right? So he wasn't talking about some highfalutin existential angst or something like that, right? He was just talking about ordinary pain or ordinary suffering. And this is, I think, something which is useful to bear in mind when we're interpreting the suttas, that we very much come to Buddhism from a top-down approach. And so this is just one example. There's many other examples where we tend to misinterpret how words are used and terms are used because we don't really understand the context of them, the background for them. Incidentally, this is one of the reasons why studying the Vinaya is very useful. Vinaya, of course, being the monastic code for the monks and nuns, and the Vinaya dealing with all of the concrete things of life, right? So when I'm just been editing the Vinaya texts, and, you know, there's very detailed passages, for example, on construction, right? So walls and plaster and front porches and stairways and toilets and all of these kinds of things, you know, all kind of described in quite a lot of detail, actually. And so you see concrete everyday uses of language, right? And so it's very important if you're dealing with philosophy to begin with what's concrete and what's real and then move towards what's abstract rather than the other way around. Okay. Yep. Sorry, was that a question? Yeah.
The Buddha was having a go at the kids for catching fish, is that right?
The Buddha's having a go at the kids for catching fish. Well, I don't know if having a go at them would be an entirely accurate description of what's going on.
Okay.
Okay, let's just...
Well, I was just thinking about what you said about how the young boys would interpret the word, whatever the word dukkha means to them. And just remembering back to similar instances when I was a kid, I guess, and there's a lot of fear and guilt and fear of punishment.
Okay.
Would be emotional pain and suffering around guilt and fear of punishment.
Sorry, do you mean specifically when you're catching fish or no? Just
or torturing ants, something like that.
And so if you did that kind of thing, then you'd feel guilty and be afraid of punishment because of it.
I guess there's two aspects of that. You know, I'd feel probably if I was caught,
right.
If someone pointed out to me that perhaps what I was doing was wrong,
yeah,
that would probably cause me to reflect on what I was actually doing to the fish or the ants. There'd be some fear of punishment, but also some shame that I'd been caught out as well. You know, it's not a straightforward emotional suffering. There's a lot of dimensions to it: fear of punishment, shame, being forced to actually connect with maybe the consciousness of the creature that I was hurting.
Yeah, and that of course would vary from kid to kid, wouldn't it? Right? Some people just feel kids would just laugh it off, and you know, others maybe. You know, imagine if it's the Buddha who's telling you stuff, right? It's not just mum and dad.
Yeah, I just thought the fact that they were running away at the end was perhaps they felt that they were being told off.
Maybe. They ran away. Maybe. Well, have a look at that line in a bit more detail. It's a bit unclear exactly what that line means, actually. Anyway, okay, so kind of imagine the scene, right? So you could put yourself back into time and place. Anyone here been to India? Has anyone been to Jetavana? Yeah? So a few of you have been to the Jetavana, so you know what it looks like, and you know where Savatthi is, right, relative to Jetavana. So it's a, you know, it's a bit of a walk away, but it's not too far away, right? So the Buddha's going for alms round, as he always would, yeah? So he gets up in the morning, puts his robe on, takes his bowl, yeah? And walking out for alms, and this of course is the regular activity that the Sangha would do, you know, I think it's interesting to that it's something that the Buddha would still do, right? I mean, the Buddha had lots of very wealthy supporters and lots of people who were looking after him and so on. You know, if he wanted to set it up so that he could just have meals in the monastery or whatever, then he could do that very easily. But he still made a point of making this practice of going for alms round. And recently I was in Sri Lanka and we talked about it. I never got round to making arrangements to go for alms in Sri Lanka, but it seems that in much of Sri Lanka anyway, the alms round practice has kind of died away. And it's not very common there, which I think is a great shame. In many places, in Colombo and so on, it's almost looked down on if the monks go for alms round, right? The ones who go for alms round are the bad monks who nobody's going to give any food to, right? in some of the forest monasteries and other places in the villages, they still do it. But a lot of places they don't. That's quite different from Thai Buddhism. In Thai Buddhism, they still pretty much everywhere they go for alms round. Yeah. When I stay in Sydney, I usually go for alms round every morning. I stay in the Buddhist Library, which is not far from King Street. So, just take my alms bowl and go down the road. So that's quite fun. Yeah. And probably in Australia generally, but certainly in Sydney and certainly in King Street, then it's not possible to be a monk and to ever go hungry, because there's like about an average of 2 Thai restaurants per street block, right? 2 or sometimes 3. On one was like one block, there'll be like maybe 3 Thai restaurants or something like that. So the only problem with going for alms really is the potential back problems that come from having to carry all the food back to the monastery. The people are very generous, and you know, this is really one of the wonderful aspects of being a monk, that you can just—it's just so simple. You just take your bowl and walk down the road, and you just rely on human kindness. Yeah. When the monks first went to England, they in the 1970s they didn't go for alms round. And when Ajahn Chah came to visit them, he said, you know, you've been going for alms round. And they said, no, it's not the custom here in England. We can't do alms round. And Ajahn Chah just said, you mean that there's no kind people in England? So then they decided to go for alms round. Yeah. And then, I don't know if you've heard this story, but then not long afterwards, they were going for alms round. They were walking through a park. Somebody came up and asked them what they were doing. And they explained, and the gentleman just kind of listened to them and so on. And then he wrote out a slip of paper and wrote something on a slip of paper and put it into the bowl. And they didn't know what it was. And then when they got back to the monastery, they took it out. And he had offered the manor home and grounds that's now Chithurst Monastery. He just offered to them while they were on alms round. So sometimes you just got to put yourself out there. I don't know if you noticed, but in the papers recently there was some scandals because of the fake Buddhist monks going out and begging for money. Did you read about that? Yeah? Everyone was like, oh, this is so terrible. Oh, how could they do that? I was like, that's fantastic. We finally made it as a Buddhist country, right? There's finally enough Buddhists here that people can actually come here and make money out of it and scam the Buddhists. I thought that's weird. We finally we hit the big time. I've been in Malaysia and Singapore. This has been an issue there for many years, as well as in Thailand. They've had some problems with this as well. So anyway, now they've got these guys dressing up. And anyway, I was in Sydney while that was happening, and it didn't seem to affect me. I still got enough to eat, so I didn't worry about it too much. Okay, very good. So that's just a bit of a background about the alms practice. Anyone got any questions about that? Huh? Has anyone here had the chance to give alms to monks or nuns when they're on alms run? Yeah? A few people have? Yeah? Right. Okay. So then the gracious one saw those... Oh, okay, so here's another question. We have here gracious one. Incidentally, this translation is by Venerable Ananda Jyoti, who's a friend of mine. He's an English monk who lives in Malaysia. So his translations... This translation's from Sutta Central, and his translations are, some of his translations are on there. And his translations are usually very precise. So here we have the gracious one, yeah, for Bhagava, it's a Pali. And instead of, normally Bhikkhu Bodhi uses the blessed one. So which is better, the gracious one or the blessed one? Or exalted one. I think Bhikkhu Bodhi sometimes uses exalted one too, yeah. Yeah. Any thoughts? Gracious, blessed, exalted.
Behavior. So uh-huh. Other people are described as being gracious.
Okay, yeah.
But blessed is special.
Okay, so blessed is specialer than gracious. Yeah, it's more specialer, sorry. It's probably true, actually, yeah. And the word Bhagava, it's a very exalted term in India. Yeah, basically, you know, it's one of the most, sort of the highest honorifics that you can use. So, yeah, possibly blessed might be better for that reason. Yeah. Yeah.
Understand.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, we call the Buddha the world-honored one.
The world-honored
one, and
by
the three worlds, the only one.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's the standard rendering in Chinese. It means the one honored in the world honored one, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it's a bit more higher. So yeah.
It's the only one, the one.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So he saw them playing and catching fish on the road between Savati and Jetta's wood. Oh, incidentally, I should before going on, I should just give some background on the Udana as a collection. I was meaning to do that earlier, and I forgot. So, as you can see, the text here is called Udana. I know that normally we give the Sutta classes for the Majjhima Nikaya or something like that. Udana is one of the minor texts in the Pali canon, And it's part of the collection called the Kuddaka Nikaya. Okay, so you might have heard mentioned sometimes of the four Nikayas or the five Nikayas. So actually in Pali you have four main collections of Nikayas, the long discourses, middle length discourses, connected discourses, and numerical discourses. And in addition to that, you have the Kuddaka Nikaya, which means the minor collection. Okay, in fact, the Kuddaka Nikaya is bigger than any of the other collections. That's why they call it the small collection. Probably it started out smaller and then got bigger, right? And that collection includes a wide range of miscellaneous texts, but a lot of the texts in the Kuddaka Nikaya have a lot of verses in them. One of the most famous of the Kuddaka Nikaya texts, of course, is the Dhammapada, which is the perhaps probably the most famous of all the Buddhist scriptures. And the Udana is another collection. Now, the Udana is in many ways very similar to the Dhammapada, and in some ways is part of the same group of literature or group of texts. The Udana as an idea means something like inspired saying, right? The root ana is same root as you find in anapanasati, is to breathe, right? So udana, the prefix ud, literally means up, okay? So it's breathing an up breath, breathing up, something like that. So it's kind of some inspired saying, and in the commentaries describe it as saying that when the speaker becomes so full of joy that they have to give forth an utterance of the Dhamma. They just can't help it because they're so full of joy. Yeah? I'm not quite sure if that exactly applies in this particular case, but anyway. So, and the Udana is one of the nine Angas, which is a group of texts, which is the earliest collection of Buddhist texts, which is mentioned in the scriptures themselves, right? So before we had the Tripitaka, before we had the Nikayas, before we had the Majjhima and Digha and so on, the discourses were organized in a framework called the Angas, which is nine Angas. And one of those nine is the Udana. So what exactly the Udana meant in that very early framework of the Angas is not entirely clear. Whether it was identical with the book we have today seems unlikely, but it was probably a collection of material which is similar to or related to the text, the Udana we have today. Like many of the Kuddaka books, the Udana exists in a number of different versions, although there's no versions that very closely correspond with the Pali text that we call the Udana. And in fact, in most of the other versions and texts called the Udana, there's no stories in them. They're just the verses. Okay, we have a couple of Sanskrit texts called Udana or Udana Varga, and similar texts also in Tibetan and Chinese. And these, if you take the prose introduction and prose backgrounds out of them and you just have the verses, you end up with something which pretty much looks like a Dhammapada, okay? So it's a collection of verses arranged in by topic. So each verse in each in the Udana, each chapter has 10 suttas, and the sutta and those 10 suttas sort of loosely follow a certain theme. There are certain details in the verses themselves that suggests that the Pali collection originally also existed without the narrative sections. Okay, so for example, we find in some of the verses that there are connections between one set of verses and a previous set of verses. Okay, whereas now these are separated by narrative sections, but actually this verse here will connect with that verse there, even though they're now in separate suttas. So it seems that originally the collection was just the verse collections. And very often what you find in the Indian literature is you find like a form, almost, in fact this is almost universal, it's so widely spread in the Indian literature, you have this form of an exposition and a summary and exposition. Okay, so a teaching in brief and then the teaching in more detail, and the teaching in brief was often what was captured and preserved in the literal form. Okay, in this case, the teaching in brief being the verse itself. Yeah, it's like the seed, And then around that seed would be the oral commentary, which would be more free-flowing, more adaptive, more responsive to the environment, and would express the personality of the speaker and so on. Much the same as what I'm doing today with this sutta class, right? So with this class, we're taking a text, which is the summary, and then I'm giving an exposition and more explanation about it. And that's the way that all of these texts were passed down in the Indian tradition, right? Except here, the text itself would have been just the verses, and then the summary, the background, would have been something to give a bit of life and flavor and color and context to the verses themselves. So for that reason, what we sometimes find is that the verses and the background stories don't really agree all that well. Okay, there's sometimes a loose connection between the verses and the background story. So, for example, if you look at this particular one, there's nothing particularly in those verses that connect it with that story. Okay, I mean, it's generically connected with the story. It talks about suffering and fear of suffering and so on. It's not inappropriate for the context, right? But it doesn't specifically mention about the boys and the fish and all of those details that make that story unique, right? So, in fact, you could use those same verses to illustrate a number of different stories, right? They're not kind of tied down to this one particular context. They're not so specific. So in many cases, we can imagine that the story developed as a way of illustrating the verses. And so this is why you often find that in different editions and different versions, that the story might differ, that you have the same verses with a different story as a background to them and so on. Right? Yeah.
Breaking the crab's legs or something.
Yeah, that was probably me who told that, and I probably mistook the crab for the fish. Actually, I mentioned before that I was I'd told this story when I was in Germany, and then I couldn't find it. And that was the reason why I couldn't find it, because I was looking for it under crabs. And so the story changed and grew in my mind over the years. So it was interesting to come back and see it again. Yeah. There's another similar one in the Udana. With the snake in it as well. Yeah. Okay, so that's just a bit more on the background. So because of that format, it seems that most of the time the verses are somewhat considered to be somewhat older or more authentic than the narrative backgrounds. Okay. So in many cases it's a bit hard to assess the authenticity of the narrative background, but there are some cases in the Udana that suggest a slightly later origin. For example, there's one place in the Udana where it mentions writing. Okay, so the writing is only mentioned there and one or two places in the Vinaya in the Pali text. So this is usually a sign of something that's a little bit later. Nothing about this story that suggests a later origin, but just on the whole, the backgrounds might be a little bit later than the verses. Okay. Anything more on that? Very quiet today. Background, origin, Udana. Oh, I should also just mention briefly that with the Udana, that the it's often translated as verses of inspiration, and that's quite an apt translation. Actually, this particular one is perhaps not so good as an example of the genre, but you find quite a few of the suttas in the Udana deal with very inspiring topics like the nature of Nibbana and things like that, which are quite uplifting and quite powerful. So it's a very nice collection if you read the translation. It's a good translation by John Ireland. As well as the translations are available on Sutta Central. And so it's a very nice smaller collection to read. Okay, so back to the sutta. The Buddha's walking along the road. So I want you to picture in your mind's eye what it's like for the Buddha to walk along the road. Notice that he isn't like floating 3 feet in the air. He's not radiating golden, multicolored light around him. There's not thousands of devas following him along. You can add those details in if you like. but they're not actually there in the text. I was in Sri Lanka recently. I attended a film screening for a new film on the life of the Buddha, Sri Siddhartha Gautama, it's called. Actually, I'm not sure if they're coming to Perth, but they're bringing the film to Australia soon. They're doing a screening in Sydney. I'm not sure if they're doing a screening here. Are they? Okay. Oh, okay, so the Sri Lankan temple's organising. Okay, so do you know what the date is? Okay, good. So, yeah, if you get the chance, then it's, very nice, nicely done film production. It tells the life of the Buddha up to, from his birth up to the night of his enlightenment, right? So it stops, it ends with this cliffhanger on the night of his enlightenment, and you're like, you don't know what's going to happen next, so you have to, so you have to come back for the next one. And one of the distinctive features of that film is that there's no miracles, right? So there's no walking on lotuses and none of these kinds of things. Yeah, it's all completely straight. Yeah, so quite nicely done like that, and it focuses on the emotions, especially of like the going forth when Siddhartha was leaving home, and then the impact that had on him and his family and his wife and all of these kinds of things. So yeah, very very kind of quite movingly done and quite nicely done. None of that stuff, no. Yeah. Yeah. I think it might be, there was a dream, I think Maya had a dream and things like that, but dreams aren't really supernatural, are they? Yeah. Yes. Is it in English? Yes, it's in English, yeah. I think they did multilingual versions of it. No, because when I saw it in Sri Lanka, the director and the director was there, and I said, "Oh, you should have done it in Pali. That would have been good." Yeah. I'm just trying to remember now. I can't even remember if it was in subtitles or was it in English. I think it was in English. I think they might have done different versions. I think they might have done it in English and in Hindi or something like that. Yeah. Anyway. So, okay. So, again, this is one of the reasons why I like this sutta is because it gives the Buddha in a very kind of normal context, right? It's just walking along the road, sees these kids playing with fish, catching fish, you know, and you know, like you're just saying, like, that's what boys do, isn't it? You know, it's the same. The kids, it's the same thing they do today. Having seen them, he went over there and said to them, "Are you afraid, boys, of suffering? Is suffering unpleasant to you?" And this, to me, is the crux of the sutta and the most important part of it, the most interesting part of it. He doesn't tell the boys, stop. Right? He doesn't tell them, you're wrong. He doesn't tell them, you're naughty. Yeah? And this is to me, is such an important thing. Yeah? And this is so characteristic of the Buddha's teaching style and the Buddha's method. Instead, he treats the boys with respect. Right? Asks them a question: Are you afraid of suffering? Is suffering unpleasant to you? And then they give the answer. Yeah? So there's only a kernel there, right? But to me, there's a kernel of a teaching method and an education method right in there. Yeah? Not trying to force Buddhism on people, right? But trying to draw out the knowledge and the wisdom that people have, even young kids, and the etymology of the word education, right, is to educe, right? So to like educe is like from a duct, like a air conditioning duct or something like that. So to educe is to draw out, right? To draw something out, and the use of the word in that kind of sense derives from the Socratic method, where Socrates believed that every person knows the truth, right? You all know everything already, yeah? And the reason that you know everything already is because you learned it in your past lives, yeah? And this is not just an incidental. This is something which histories of Western philosophy kind of gloss over. But actually, all of the Greek philosophers believed in rebirth. And for Socrates, his belief in rebirth wasn't just an incidental sort of metaphysical belief. It was the foundation of his whole approach. And his whole method, they call the Socratic method, is built on the assumption that we all know everything because we've learnt it in our past lives. Yeah? And so that, if you look at the Socratic method, is always this method of question and counter-question. Yeah? That's how he always would be in these dialogues, right? Exactly the same, but it's a much simpler one here that the Buddha's giving, but it's the same idea, that you're assuming that person knows the answer, and your job as an educator is to not tell them what's the truth, but to draw out from them the wisdom which they already have. Yeah? This is to educe. And Socrates actually demonstrated this when he wanted to prove his point, prove that this was the case. He did it by questioning a young slave boy. Right? Again, the same kind of example of putting it in a context of educating children. I can't remember what the name of the dialogue is now. One of the Socratic dialogues, and he says, if you want me to prove this, he says, okay, this is slave boy here, and they were just talking, and he says, this kid understands geometry. Right? Now, of course, in ancient Greece, geometry was one of the highest and most advanced of all of the sciences, right? And so to suggest, and it was something, you had to do long years of training and so on to be able to master. And so for Socrates to suggest that this unlettered slave boy would know geometry was completely outrageous. And then he set out to prove it, right? And so he just got a stick and a bit of dirt and drew a line on the dirt and said, okay, there's this line. And then just took him step by step through a geometrical proof. And each step of the way would be questioning the kid and drawing out his knowledge. And he showed that he actually understood this proof each step of the way. And so this is very much what you see the Buddha doing here. But what's interesting is that the word education, meaning to lead out, is exactly the same etymology as the word vinaya, right? So we're used to hearing the word vinaya as being the discipline, for the list of rules and so on for monks and nuns. But actually the literal meaning of the word vinaya is to lead out. Yeah, and so it has that same kind of meaning of leading out. So here he's assuming that the kids already know what's right and what's wrong. And so his job is to question them and get them to become conscious of it, right? Because they knew it, actually, but they didn't, they just didn't act in accordance with what they knew. They didn't do the right thing, but they knew what the right thing was. So this is what I always do when people come, families come and they say, please teach our children the Dhamma. And then I just do something like this and ask the kids, about suffering and pain and is it right to cause pain and is it wrong to cause suffering? And the kids always know. And then I tell the parents, what do you want me to teach them? They already know what Dhamma is, yeah? So that's a good way I can use to get out of having to do more teaching of kids. But it's also it's also very true. And sometimes we think that in the Buddhism community, we think that we need to impose our Dhamma knowledge on children and so on. Whereas in fact, to me, it's not so important. I mean, yes, of course, there's something which is valuable in terms of learning about the Buddhist tradition and the stories and so on and so forth, and having some familiarity with it. So that's something which is good, but that's not crucial. That's just on the surface of things. The really important thing is to learn how to live well, how to be able to make the right choices, how to be able to distinguish from right from wrong, how to be able to live in a way that leads to happiness for oneself and for others. And these are things which don't really have to be presented in a Buddhist framework or context at all. Yeah? These are things which actually are just part of life. And so here, the very foundation of Buddhist ethics is the relationship between what is right and what is painful, right? Between goodness and happiness, the relationship between doing bad and suffering. And this is in other religions, in theistic religions, for example, right and wrong is, of course, what's determined by God, right? So God says, thou shalt or thou shalt not, and then that's what's right and that's what's wrong, right? Whereas here, what's right and what's wrong is a reflection on the nature of suffering, right? Which a person does themselves. Yeah? So the Buddha's not there to lay down rules and tell people what to do. He's there to draw out your innate wisdom. And it's interesting, I've been living in Sydney for the last 10 years, and there's been some discussion and some controversy about education in the New South Wales education system, and there's similar discussions going on in different parts of Australia. And the situation that we had in New South Wales, or we still have, is that you have what's called SRE and GRE, and SRE in the primary school, special religious education, basically is where the different religious groups, religious organisations, get teachers and they send them into schools and they teach the kids about their own religion. And this is something which is quite problematic in many ways because there's no oversight from the government or the school about what's actually taught in these classes. So obviously in many cases it's fine, but in some cases it might be quite questionable. And it's also problematic because obviously not all kids want to do that or have parents who want them to do that. And it's difficult also for minority religions to provide enough teachers to do those jobs, and especially religions where there's a large immigrant community, because then, of course, often you find the parents don't have such good English, so it's hard for them to supply enough teachers. So as a Buddhist community in Sydney, we really struggle to get enough teachers to go into the schools and teach. There's a few schools that have a good program, but many of them, they don't. And so what the Sydney government, there was a proposal to, or the New South Wales government had a proposal to introduce an ethics class for children as a way of supplementing these religious classes. So if you didn't want to go to the religion classes, you could go to an ethics class, right? And the interesting thing about the ethics class was that it was done, again, in very much the same kind of way, introducing ethical problems to the kids, getting them to discuss it and to draw out the implications and so on. So it provided a framework for them to find out their own understanding of what's right and wrong and to be able to draw that out and figure it out for themselves. Yeah. Now, from a Buddhist point of view, you know, we were the Buddhists in New South Wales, like, oh, this is terrific, you know, so the kids can go off and do that. Curiously enough, the many of the Anglicans and Catholics in Sydney, or at least the bosses of the hierarchies of the Anglicans and Catholics, were outraged by this suggestion, right? And drastically opposed the introduction of teaching ethics in schools, right? Completely incomprehensible why they would do that. But of course, the problem is that it was teaching the children that they could work out for themselves what's right and what's wrong. Yeah? And that's a very, very dangerous idea. Yeah? Yeah? You need to have somebody who is in authority who can teach you what's right and what's wrong. And so there was a very strong, there still is a very strong opposition to this from the very conservative Catholic and Anglican hierarchies in Sydney. Obviously not all the Catholics and Anglicans, but just the leaders of those groups in Sydney are highly conservative and highly reactive. In fact, the day that the bill was introduced into Parliament, one of Sydney's most notorious public figures is Reverend Fred Nile, who many of you would know, is the ultra-conservative evangelist in the Sydney Parliament. And he introduced the opposition to this idea and said that other religious groups also oppose this, including the Buddhists, right? So we were being quoted in Parliament as opposing this ethics classes, right? It was completely crazy, right? And so as soon as we found out about this, we sort of, you know, jumped on it and said, no, actually we support it and so on, which is fine, except, of course, the vote had already been taken, right? He said this in Parliament just before the vote was taken. So that's how politics works. So anyway, so from my point of view, you know, that way of teaching ethics, which was being introduced in those ethics classes, is precisely the Buddhist way of teaching ethics. You know, I don't think it's any different. And this is a way of teaching it that will really engage with people, and not be just a list of things which you just say by rote. And to me, this is so important. You need to, if you want to teach morality and teach ethics, you have to start where people are at. You have to start with their own understanding and can draw a little bit by little bit out from there. Okay. Any comments, questions? No? Do they have a teaching program in schools in WA? Anything run by the BSWA? No? No? Really? So what happens to kids in schools in WA? They learn Christianity in Baha'i. Excellent. Wayne? Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's, and I think that idea that you find in the Mahayana, where every all beings are already enlightened, and I think this is where that notion, yeah, it's where that notion comes from. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's not ethics, is it? I said that Socrates said that everything's inside you, whether he's right or not. But that's similarly, even with not self. I mean, if you look at how the Buddha presented the discourse on not self, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, yeah, Dankin Manyata Bhikkhave Rupang Nichang Wa Anichang Vati. What do you think, monks? Is form permanent or impermanent? It's impermanent. Is what is permanent suffering or happiness? It's suffering. Is what you can is impermanent and suffering and subject to change? Is that fit to be considered? This is me. This is what I am. This is myself. No, Bhante. Yeah. So he's actually using the same method there, to little bit by little bit to go through and to draw that response out. Yeah. And it's something which is so characteristic of the Buddha's teachings. If you don't notice it, you don't realize how pervasive it is. But it's so common right the way through as this means of question and answer. Yeah. Wayne? Sorry, what would be a definition? Yonaso Manasikara, yeah. That's right, yeah. Exactly, and with the questioning method is yonaso manasikara means like inward reflecting, and so that method of questioning is a way of stimulating that, and stimulating that inner inquiry. Yeah, absolutely, yeah, absolutely, and so you can see with these kids, you can see that the difference. You know, on a shallow point of view, right, is it kind of shallow ethics or sort of conventional ethics? You know, you tell the kids, don't take the fish, right? You put up a sign there saying, don't fish, fine, $200 or something like that, right? And maybe you can control behavior, right? So you might actually get a good outcome in the sense where less fish are going to be hurt, right, which might be good. But there's no wisdom there. Right? So from a Buddhist point of view, you're always playing the long game. Right? Now, in terms of effectiveness, which is more effective in getting the kids to stop fishing? Right? Is it more effective to say, don't fish? Or is it more effective to engage them and to get them to reflect? Right? Well, you might find one way or the other. Right? Sometimes it might be more effective just to say, don't do it. If you do it, I'll hit you. Right? Sometimes you don't have time to say anything else. Right? So sometimes that might be... might get the response that you want, but that's all it does. It controls someone's behavior for a little while and doesn't really get you any further. In fact, they're just as likely to go off and do it somewhere else if you tell them not to do that. So I remember when we were kids in Perth, we used to jump off the cliffs down on the riverfront down in near Atterdale, down on the river there. There's some quite high rocks, and we used to go down and jump off them and so on. And then one of my friends, his mum found out we were doing this, and then she banned him. She said, no jumping off cliffs, right? And so he told me about this, and he said, it's more like a high rock, really, isn't it? than a cliff as such. Anyway. Okay. So then that conversation is quite brief, right? It only gives the essence of it, right? The Buddha asks this question and the kids reply. I mean, I like to imagine there's perhaps somewhat more to it. But I wonder what it would feel like if you're a kid and you're playing around and then the Buddha comes up and talks to you. It must be quite a quite a thing. Anyway, so then the Buddha gives these verses, the inspired verses. If you have any fear of suffering, if suffering's unpleasant to you, don't do any bad deeds, whether in the open or in secret. So so that's obviously connecting with directly with the teaching. One word which probably calls for comment is the word that we've translated here is bad. Now, the word they're translating here is bad is papa in Pali. And I think in Hugh and the version that you were reading was, it said evil, right? Evil, yeah. So this word papa, in fact, is, I mentioned a little bit before that in the Udana you tend to have groups of 10 suttas which are connected by a theme. Now, in this particular chapter, the fifth chapter, is only very loosely connected by a theme, but if there is a theme to connect them, then probably this theme of papa is the running theme here. Often translated as evil, right? But evil seems a bit full on, doesn't it? Right? I mean, evil in English is a pretty heavy kind of word, right? If kids are playing with fish in a pond, you might say it's naughty or bad, but you wouldn't say it's evil, right? So I think Ananda Jyoti is just simply translating it as bad is probably better than evil in this context. Yeah, I think Bhikkhu Bodhi still uses evil though for papa. Lynn, yeah. Papa, P-A-P-A, as in Il Papa, the Pope, or in Pali would be the evil one. I can't help it, okay, that's just what the word is. When Ajahn Chandiko was starting his monastery in New Zealand, the name of the road that the monastery was on sounds very much like a Pali word. Even though it was probably like a Maori word or something. And he asked me what the meaning was, and the word is paparata, which I said it means lover of evil. That's a bit unfortunate. But anyway, moving along. Okay. But if you will do or now do bad deeds, for you there's no freedom from suffering, even after going while running away. Okay, so as I mentioned before, the translation, especially the last phrase here, is a bit obscure. I don't quite agree with Ananda Jyoti's rendering here. Even after going while running away, the word is I'm just remembering what the word is now. I think it's upeccha. I think it's upeccha. I think it's upechapi, which I would translate as normally means to approach or to come near. Right. So perhaps you'd translate it as there's no escape when whether coming or going. Palayati. And I think the sense of it is clear enough. Basically, the sense is that you can't escape from the if you do bad karma, you can't escape from it, no matter what you do, right? Is the sense of it. But what the exact force of the idiom is a bit hard to figure out. So I would say while coming or going, perhaps might be more literal. What did you have there for that one? The last line there, Hugh. Though you spring up and flee, yeah. Again, upeccha doesn't really mean to spring up. Yeah. perhaps it means one near or far, something like that. Yeah, anyway, it's a poetic idiom, so you probably don't want to press it too hard for a literal meaning. Yeah? But anyway, I think the sense of it is clear enough that you can't get free from it. So again, pointing out to the children that, again, not saying do this and don't do this and so on, but saying that if you choose to do that, there will be that result. Yeah, and this is the one of the keys to moral conduct and to ethical conduct, isn't it? That the results for things are hidden from us. Right? We make choices. Yeah? And we have a sense when we make choices, you make ethical choices, you have a sense inside yourself of whether this is right or wrong. Yeah? Now that sense might be clear or not clear, sometimes you might be in doubt. But usually you, there's a feeling that you know this is the right thing to do or this is the wrong thing to do. But what we often don't consider and what's hidden from us is what's the result of things. And unless we make an effort, right, you have to consciously make an effort to reflect about what the future result of it is, then you can connect. And what you see is that there's a connection between that feeling of doing the right thing or not doing the right thing and then what is the result? The result being suffering or happiness. And this is the fundamental basis of Buddhist ethics. So important to understand this. The basis of Buddhist ethics is the connection between doing good acts leading to happiness, doing bad acts leading to suffering. So in this way, Buddhist ethics is entirely empirical and utilitarian. Right? It's utilitarian in the sense that good and bad is intimately connected with the notion of what is pleasant and unpleasant, right? So by utilitarian, I mean the utilitarian ethical philosophies developed in the 19th century England, John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham and so on. And they developed this idea that we can base our ethical choices, what's right and wrong, on whether they result in happiness or suffering. Yeah? The standard formulation is that what brings the greatest good for the greatest number is regarded as being the what's right. And that utilitarian philosophy in Western thought is quite radical and quite revolutionary because it grounds morality on human experience rather than grounding morality on either the dictates of a god or on some abstract philosophical notion. Right? It's very much grounded on what's experienced. It's not grounded on understanding like Socratic philosophy of what is the right or what is the good and the idea that it should be self-evident for you what's good and so on. And this is very kind of abstract. And this is based on your actual experience of good and bad, your experience of pleasure and pain, which is one of the foundational experiences that we all have as sentient beings. So this is very much how the Buddha grounded his philosophy. Ethical philosophy. Now, it's not the Buddhist approach to things is not quite identical with the Western utilitarian philosophy. Okay, there are some differences. Most obvious one being that in the Buddhist point of view, you also take into account past lives and future lives, right? And the differences actually solve many of the great problems which Western utilitarianism has, right? So one of the big problems with utilitarianism is how come bad people sometimes are happy, right? And you know, if we it instinctively feels right to us that there's a connection between doing good and happiness, right? And we feel that ourselves. But it's also the case that sometimes there are people who do lots of really, really bad things and, I don't know, they seem quite happy, yeah? And so you can try to justify your way or around that and argue, well, they just look happy, but they're not really happy underneath, yeah? And, but, what? Well, exactly. How do you know? Maybe they really are happy. Yeah. 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 So from a Buddhist point of view, then we understand that in terms of karma, which is basically just means that there's a delay, there's a period of time, or there can be a period of time between cause and effect. So sometimes you'll experience the results straight away, and then sometimes it'll take different periods of time for that to happen. So that's only one example. So there are differences between the Western utilitarian philosophy and the Buddhist philosophy, but it is still I think, are taking basically the same approach and a similar approach to grounding ethics. So ethics is grounded in experience rather than being grounded in, on the one hand, a dictates of a god, or on the other hand, a abstract philosophical notion. If you kill the bad guy, then people's problem will be solved. Oh, right, yeah. Right. Right, this is another utilitarian argument, right? So, yeah, you can justify... okay... So, what? Yeah. Yeah. So this is another common argument with utilitarianism: is if utilitarianism is correct, the greatest good, what is good means what brings the greatest happiness for the greatest number, then you could, in principle anyway, you can start to justify some quite what appear to be quite problematic things, right? So if you think somebody's a going to be a murderer or whatever, then you can just take them out, right? I mean, this just seems to be a fairly common practice, doesn't it? I mean, it seems to be policy of certain governments is that if there's somebody who's bad, you can just kill them, and that's okay, yeah? And that seems to be the kind of justification. Again, not really from that same point of view in Buddhism, because, again, we're taking into account the notion of karma. And so one of the differences is between Buddhism and Western utilitarianism is the emphasis on the intention that lies behind the act, which is what the karma is. So it's not just about what the result is, but also about the intention, right? And one thing that you find in philosophy, certainly in ethical philosophy, right, if you try to make it too, if you try to base it on one thing, right, you always end up with that kind of counterintuitive result, right? Moral philosophy is an attempt to provide a theoretical framework which can sort of consistently and coherently account for our moral intuitions, right? So it can explain why we think some things are bad and some things are good, and can give us guidance in areas where it's hard to find those things out, right? But almost every case, you can find that whatever moral philosophy you choose, if it's based on one simple principle, it will always lead to some ridiculous or revolting counterintuitive conclusion. Yeah? And so, from the Buddhist point of view, rather than choosing just that one thing or what's the greatest happiness for the greatest number, but it's also about what is your intention, right? So these two things are always working both. It's both the result and the cause. And so it's much more interactive. And then that gives it more flexibility it's more responsive and more. It doesn't tend to lead to those kind of extreme results. Okay, so for example, in that kind of case, you can say, well, if you can kill one bad guy, that can stop him from killing a lot of others, and that's going to lead to the greatest happiness of the greatest number, right? But then, what is your intention, right? So by your intention to kill, you're creating the bad karma of killing, which is going to result for suffering for yourself in the future. Yeah. Whereas that person's intention to kill those other people, right? They're going to die, so they're going to suffer now, but, you know, they'll be reborn and so on later, right? Yeah. So you're taking into account those intentions. So what you might, in fact, argue is by killing that person, you're stopping them. What you're really doing is not stopping them from killing, but you're stopping them from committing the bad karma, which is going to cause suffering for them in the future. Yeah. So that should be your justification. Of course, from a Buddhist point of view, you'd say, well, look, if there's another way of doing that, that would be much nicer, right? Perhaps you can persuade him to do otherwise, or if you can't persuade them to do otherwise, you might want to lock them up, yeah, or something like that. But also from a Buddhist point of view, we don't have to conclude that something is either black or white. That's another very important aspect of Buddhist ethics, right? There's black karma with black result, white karma with white result, black and white karma with black and white result, right? and neither black nor white come up with neither black nor white result. Yeah? So in this case here with the boys and the fish, it's pretty straightforward. It's just they're hurting the fish. It's not really doing any good for anybody. So it's a bad thing, and so it's not a good idea to do it. But in some cases, you know, you might wonder. So you might think, well, look, if this man is a serial killer and he's going to go off and kill another six people, am I justified in killing them now? Let's assume that there's no other choices. And you might think, well, this is a black and white comer. It's white because I'm going to save those other people, but it's black because I'm going to commit the act of killing this person. Okay? So that's a kind of mixed comma. And when you might think, well, it's not justified, right? You might think that it's not for me to play that kind of role, right? The problem is, though, that you just have to jiggle the numbers a bit, and that eventually it becomes hard to refuse, right? If you can, and the ultimate example is, should you kill Hitler, right? So, really? Would it be right to kill Hitler in order to stop tens of millions of people from dying in the Second World War? I think, you know, most people, even if they're Buddhist monks, would probably struggle with that one, not having the opportunity, if you had the opportunity to kill Hitler. You'd be happy to leave Hitler to make those choices?
It's all good, but what was he doing? He wasn't talking about karma, because little children really can't understand karma, because they understand what's happening right in the moment, nothing else. So how did he teach them? What was he doing? What was the process that he was using? He was just saying, as me, so you. That's the Buddhist teaching. As the fish, so you. As you, so the fish. If your mother, if someone killed your mother, how would you feel? Oh, I'd feel terrible. So you don't kill someone else's mother. If you kill the fish, how are they going to feel? You're going to feel bad. How would you feel if someone killed you? I think that's the real issue. And he's teaching them very directly, very immediately, without any philosophy involved in it. And they could understand that right away, as me, so you. That's the teaching. And that is the Buddhist teaching, always. Immediate, akalika, rather than in the future. I don't believe in this idea of karma. I mean, there is karma, but you don't have to understand karma. As me, so you. As I do right now, if I kill Hitler right now, how am I going to feel? What is this idea about saving all the world? It's just an idea. It's still, you're creating bad karma. And if everyone had this idea, the Buddha is always going to the absolute. And the absolute is not to hurt anyone. That is the most important, because otherwise it keeps going. The whole thing keeps going. There's no end to it. Everyone is safe with me, hopefully. I hope so.
So I think the class is supposed to finish at 4:15, is that right? Supposed to wrap up? Yeah. So it's now close to finishing time. Any more questions before we wrap up?